Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. This week we're joined by Daniel Harris. He's a freelance writer, predominantly with The Guardian, but he's also a published author. He helped write Kevin Peterson's book on Kevin Peterson on cricket. He's also behind a Dart film called House of Flying Arrows, and most recently was one of the driving factors behind the film about Matt Busby's life, and that gives you an indication of Daniel's fanatical support for Manchester United. It's something he's not shy about on his social media, on his Twitter. And I met up with him in Finchley, in a cafe in North Finchley, where we talked about to almost Alan Partridge levels of support, I think, from the Alan Partridge fan, of Daniel's love for Eric Cantona. He really does love Eric Cantona. It's incredible. And then we talked about Brian Robson. We just talked about general Manchester United love from Daniel and what it meant to be a United fan as it kicked off. So fascinating chat, bit of swearing as you'll hear, and yeah, I really enjoyed it. Sort of first approached Daniel about 18 months ago and it's finally worked out, and I think it's turned out to be a really good chat about United, and I hope you enjoy. See you at the end.
I am going to choose probably in all my years of watching football and all my years of watching Man United play football, I'm going to choose a moment on January the 15th, 1995, when Eric Cantona decided to kick racism out of football. So what happened was, United were actually, they were playing Crystal Palace, they were wearing the black kit, it was cold, and I was there with my dad, and we were sitting in the Arthur Waite stand, which is opposite where all the enjoyment happened. And United were finding it a struggle. Actually, I can't remember. I think it was 0-0. I'm pretty sure it was 0-0 at the time. And Richard Shaw had been given Eric Cantona some hassle during the game. And then the ball comes in the air. Everyone knows what happened next. Cantona flicks a foot. He gets sent off. And on his way down the touchline, someone decides to have a chat. So Eric decides what he's going to do. And the reason why I've chosen this moment is actually manyfold. So let's start with the fact that what he actually did and who he actually was. So I would say that I've never seen a relationship between a player and a support like the relationship between United and Cantona. I think the reason for that is that Eric Cantona represented more or less everything that Manchester United represents. He played with flair, he played with passion, he played with aggression, he played with joy, he played with improvisation, and he was cool as fuck. And those are all the things that Manchester United are meant to be. And obviously by then, Eric Cantona had also been sent off a couple of times. He'd accidentally wiped his studs on John Moncur. He'd been sent off quite unfortunately at Arsenal. But what he'd also done was he was basically Big Lebowski's rug in terms of Alex Ferguson's first great Man United team. All the elements were in place, but it needed something to tie it together. And by serendipity, by fluke, whatever you want to call it, because if Alex Ferguson was anything, he was a lucky man. But Eric Cantona tied it all together, but he did it in such a way with so much flair, with so much love, with so much aggression. All these words I keep repeating myself already. Eric Cantona was all of those things. And United hadn't won the league before he arrived, obviously, in a very long time, in 26 years. And then as soon as he arrived, suddenly they turned into this unbelievable attacking football team. And the reason was mainly Eric Cantona. So there was that sense of symbioticism between him and between United support. They'd since won another league title, again totally inspired by him. He then scored two goals in the cup final as well, two penalties in the most offhand, calm, composed way possible, the coolest way possible in the end. And then United were doing pretty well in the league the following season, and then to see Eric Cantona get sent off again, and then for people to start with him, okay, seen that before. But obviously what happened next was unlike anything anyone had seen before at a football match, and that is the precise reason why we go to football matches, or at least one of the reasons we go to football matches, is to see something that will make us go, what the fuck have I just seen? Oops.
Yeah, just we're in a cafe here in Finchley, and Daniel doesn't realise there's a youngster behind him, so we'll just rein that in. So ultimately, we I mean, it's a phrase.
Sorry. it's okay. It's a phrase that we're seeing on Twitter quite a lot now. Is, you know, when people say, oh, these are scenes we don't want to see, and it's like, no, we really want to do these scenes. Yeah. So you're in the ground, and obviously were you in the home end? Because we just need to remind people, because this was Palace, a rare foray at the time for Palace to be in the Premier League. So it was the first time, I think, for a long time we'd seen Premier League football for Palace at Selhurst Park.
They came up, I think, in they're in the Premier League in the top, no, it's the first division then, in 91-92, because that's when Liverpool beat them 9-0.
Yes.
But around the time United had drawn with them, and I remember thinking, this team is not going to win the league.
Yeah.
Was it no, maybe it wasn't 91-92 actually. It was
I think
it was earlier.
They only had one season, and then they come up, go down, come up, go down.
Yeah.
But what was it like? Because did you get to go to Old Trafford much that season? So, or was this
so it was
nice
one of those. It was one of those. So the thing with Palace, and it was always like when United were away to Palace, United were away at Wimbledon, United would basically take over the ground, and there were just Reds everywhere. And it wasn't even, I mean, I was a kid, so you could celebrate whatever because no one's going to do anything. Because, I mean, by then, I guess I wasn't so much of a kid, I was 16, and so you probably could get a tickle. But it didn't matter because everywhere was United. And I was there with my dad, and going to football with my dad. Well, I mean, I'm no different to anyone else in this. You go to football with your dad, it's a kind of special thing that sometimes you think about. And other times you just think, well, this is just normal. But my dad passed United on to me, and his dad had a season ticket at Old Trafford in the 40s and 50s. And I have tried to pass it on to my daughter. She is not remotely interested.
Not
absolutely,
having it at all.
Absolutely not having it.
Give it time.
Yeah, but it's one of... But it's, I mean, you have this issue. You have this thing with any kind of football team, that basically a football team is the only thing that will be with you, from you can be sure will be with you from the time you're born till the time you die, because you might fall out of love with people. They might fall out of love with you, more likely, if you like football.
Yeah.
You might fall out of friendship with people. You might bin religion. You might change religion. Any of those things are possible, but your football team is your football team, and that's why people take football so seriously. I mean, partly they take football so seriously because they're mad. But they also take football seriously because it represents who they are, represents where they're from, it represents where their family's from, it represents heritage, it represents the things that people really care about, and it does it in such a way that it gives us like a particular kind of joy and entertainment in our boring lives that we wouldn't get from anywhere else. And Eric Cantona was all of those things, and Manchester United all of those things for me.
And just before we get back into your view of the incident and all that, Cantona was the first since Brian Robson, but Brian Robson was largely playing in a not in a mediocre team, but a team that wasn't doing well. But all of a sudden, you've got all these elements of people doing well. Robson at the time is coming towards the end of his career. Cantona was the first focal point that United had for a long time, and not focal point for the players and the fans. Is that a fair way to assume?
Not exactly. I would say when Mark Hughes came back from Barcelona, he was that for a bit, but he was a warrior in the same way. So through the 80s, United basically had three warriors. They had Robson, Whiteside and Hughes, who everyone loved because of the way that they played. And they were brilliant players, and brilliant, particularly those three, and Cantona was this too. They were brilliant big game players. They're like Norman Whiteside scored in cup finals, in cup semi-finals. Brian Robson scored cup finals, cup semi-finals, scored against, Hughes also scored against Liverpool, and Hughes continued to do that subsequent to Cantona. And Cantona was also that person. When you needed a goal, Eric Cantona would score a goal or create a goal. And it's that kind of attitude. But what I think the difference with Cantona was that, I mean, we could just call it cool, in that Brian Robson was cool in a different way. Like, he was kind of handsome, I guess, but he wasn't. Eric Cantona was a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
And to transport that and put it in a black United shirt with the collar up and give it that extra Gaelic twizzle is amazing. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was at school during the Cantona days, and I used to walk around with my blazer with my collars up, with 7 Cantona Tipexed on the back of my blazer. I went to a Jewish school, so we had to wear what's called a kippah. Other people might call it a yarmulke or a skull cap. I had one that was crocheted with 7 Cantona on it, and I had another one that I wore for school that had Tipexed 7 Cantona on it.
I'm beginning to think you were slightly obsessed with Cantona, aren't you, Daniel?
I remember talking to someone from United We Stand once. From United We Stand, but about a fanzine piece about stupid things you've done for Eric Cantona. So here's the most stupid thing I've done for Eric Cantona. And I guess now I'm 40, I take particular pleasure in when I did it, because I did it in the summer of 1995 when he was suspended for booting Matthew Simmons. And this is what I did. I was on holiday in Israel, and I went on the beach on my last day of my holiday with no sun cream on. The reason why I did that was because with using plasters, like those long plasters, I stuck a number 7 on my chest, on my heart, and sunburned into myself the number 7. And I remember like just sitting on the way home, because it was the last day of my holiday, just absolutely smarting through my clothes. But
it was worth it.
It was I had a number 7 for many, many months afterwards. And
just going for the Alan Partridge reference here, Daniel, but did at any point have you asked Eric Cantona if he wants to come and see his brother-in-law John in Leeds?
I believe Eric Cantona has a similar tribute to me on right, his body. Okay. I did once meet Eric Cantona subsequently, and I was in a bar in Madrid before United played Madrid in 2000, and I was just looking out the window. It's the Eric Cantona. I remember charging out and flung my arms around him. He was wearing a leather jacket, and he'd just finished playing, so he was quite thick set at that point. I remember being a bit of a stretch, so I gave him a very large hug and a kiss, and I thanked him for all his work. But to bring it back to the subject before I start,
before this becomes a proper love,
yeah. Before it becomes the what are the stories I have about Eric Cantona,
I feel I'm out of stage an intervention. Just Eric coming Cantona.
Is my favourite Eric moment is still what he did at Selhurst Park. And the reason for that is, well, number one, it was, yeah, that bloke started on you, and why should he be able to say those things to you and feel like you might not get some back? In any walk of life, free speech means that you can say that stuff to someone in some ways, if you decide that racism and xenophobia are different, because I guess we're really calling this xenophobia.
Yeah.
But you have to know that if you do it, you might get a tickle.
Yes.
I mean, that seems to me to be the quid pro quo. If someone said that to you in the street, you would feel, if you weren't me, given that I've never in my life been in the fight or hit anyone, but I would feel that I would be in my rights.
You've got the right to do it, yes.
Yeah, and if I did it to someone, I would definitely expect them to turn my jaw.
Exactly. When you're in the ground, because as you say, you're opposite to it. Now, we've been in stadiums where you kind of hear the chatter. Was it like that sensation where you kind of get, there's a roar at one part of the ground and you're like, what's that? And then you realise what's happened.
Well,
to get a view of it.
You're watching Eric. You didn't exactly have a proper view, but you could see that there was a scuffle with Eric and someone in the crowd. And the fact that I'm even referring to him as Eric also sort of tells you something similar. When I think about players who I have referred to by their first name, because in general this is something I like people take the piss out of. Like, I remember I was doing a minute by minute for The Guardian, and I was writing in the Arsenal team, and I put them all in their first names, because I'd noticed, I guess, on Twitter that Arsenal players like calling people Alex and Nacho. It's just like, lads, these are not your mates.
I know.
But there are a few, and partly it's to do with what the name is. So if it's an unusual name, so people call Rio Ferdinand Rio.
Yeah.
And that is more to do with the fact that there aren't many people called Rio, I think, rather than a particular sign of affection.
Yeah.
But otherwise, Bobby, George, Dennis, Ole, Eric.
Yeah.
It's basically those are the guys who people have referred to by their first names. And I think my dad's dad, who I never met, who is the reason I'm a United supporter, was also called Eric.
Oh, okay.
So I always took a little bit of pleasure in that.
Exactly.
So
you went, when you were in the ground, what was your immediate reaction?
Get him, Eric. I mean, come on. Like, you're never sure what's happened. But the thing about Cantona was that he wasn't a thug, in that, like, he didn't just boo people up in the air generally for no reason.
Yeah, there would usually, as you said, you referenced before, the accidental scrape. I mean, it was John Moncair's fault that he was in the way, wasn't he?
Everyone. It's like when Walter Raleigh, when he throws down his coat so the Queen could walk over a puddle.
Is that what
John Moncair was doing? John Moncair.
John, if you're listening, we hope that you
didn't want Eric to tread on the dirty ground. But I think the thing that, in retrospect, that I loved about it, and I remember going to school the next day, and obviously you're buzzing because of what you've seen, and United even win the game. United then scored, David May scored, and Southgate equalised for Palace, and it was a draw. It was kind of felt like it might have been a costly draw at the time, but there was people, like, you're strutting around school still with your collar up. And I think what happened there was that Eric Cantona basically decided that he wasn't prepared to have this, and he's like, mm-hmm. "This is who I am." And as a, I mean, it was, I was 15 at the time. As a 15-year-old trying to work out what kind of person you are, what kind of person do you want to be, what Eric Cantona taught was that you should always be true to yourself in all circumstances, and it doesn't actually matter always what the consequences are, provided you're true to yourself, because that is the most important thing. And I remember a few weeks after it happened, probably about 3-4 weeks after it happened, I was running this weekend for like this, in a synagogue for kids, and the tradition was that like it would be like over Friday and Saturday, and then just before Shabbat, the Sabbath, is about to depart, it's like tradition that someone would stand up and speak a few words of Torah, and that was me. I was the person that had to stand up and speak a few holy words. So I stood up and I started off by recounting this anecdote about the person I called my friend Eric. And this was the lesson, like I taught to these kids, was that what Matthew Simmons said to Eric was unacceptable, and what Eric said to Matthew Simmons was, "I'm not putting up with this, and this is who I am, and if you don't like it, then that is your problem, but you are the person who's in the wrong here, not me." And I wrote about it quite a lot of years later when I was talking about my experience of being a lawyer. And I was a lawyer in a city law firm, which is the most baffling thing I've ever done in my life. Not that I wanted to do it, and I knew it was baffling when I was doing it, but still the thing that makes me think, how on earth did I go and work in a big city law firm? And what on earth was I doing? Yeah. Even though I know what I was doing, I was sort of hassled into it by the girl I was with at the time. But... And I was in a situation where, so I had this supervisor, and she was not a pleasant lady, and she generally appeared to be very bitter with the cosmos for not having sent her a handsome man to ravish her into marriage.
Right.
And she was just like, I wouldn't say we didn't get on, because she didn't really talk to me very much. We just sit opposite each other. But I remember her going to Glastonbury and coming back, and I was like, "Did you see New Order? No. Did you see Primal Scream? No." I can't remember who else was there, but it was like her, and she's like, "I saw The Killers, and I saw Franz Ferdinand, and I saw Travis," or whoever, and I was just like, head in my hands, this is who you are.
Yeah.
And then we got very busy, and she didn't have any work to give me, which is obviously a good thing, because I could just sit there and order stuff off eBay and play on the internet, so it was good. But then she decided that me tapping my fingers on the keyboard was too disturbing, so could I go and find some other room to sit in? So I get to work at, we worked, I think it was 9:30 till 5:30. So most people were working sort of 9:30 till like 3 in the morning or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'd get in at 9:30, I'd say, "Go and say hello." "Any work?" "No." And I'd go and sit in this room, just me on my bill, until the end of the day. And it was extremely weird. I was also...
Sounds amazing, to be honest.
I was also going through a divorce at the time. And the wife who had basically made me be there was now not... We were now not married anymore. So it was also like quite a lot of emotional upheaval. And the reason why I had no longer had even had any reason to be there. So it was just like, what is going on? So I'd had this other boss previous to that, and he had once totally lost his shit with me when he asked me to do something. He hadn't really given me proper instructions, and he was never around because he was amazingly busy and the most senior partner in the firm. So people come to the office, say, "Is James there?" And he'd go, "No, he's not there." Then they'd wait outside, and he'd come and he'd go, "I'm too busy to speak to you, but if you walk with me to the toilet, then I can give you 2 minutes." He was that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And he was head of this company law society that made him, and being so, made him carnally excited. He asked me to do this email. I messed it up. I sent the wrong thing because the secretary told me what to send.
Yeah, yeah.
I backed her judgment over my own. And he comes back, discovers that it's happened, and he absolutely loses it with me, screaming and shouting.
Yeah.
And I stood there, and I took it. And I'm standing there thinking, what on earth is going on?
Like, yeah.
This is not really my personality.
No.
But I'm standing here and I'm taking this. And so I decided that, what would Eric Cantona do? Would Eric Cantona have stood there and took this, what we call in Yiddish, a mapola, a going over, a bollocking from this idiot or not? No, Eric Cantona would not have done that. So when I had to this woman, we were going to court, and I turned up for work one day. She had this case in court, which is why she couldn't speak to me for a few weeks. And I turned up and I walk in, and it was summer, and we were allowed to wear terrible polo shirts and chinos in the summer. Yeah, it looked an absolute treat, I can tell you. And I walk in the door, and she goes, "Daniel, tell me you've brought a suit." And I said, "No, I haven't brought a suit." "Why haven't you brought a suit? You know you're going to court." I said, "No, I know I'm delivering boxes to court." "You know you're going to court. I told you so." And I said, "You haven't told me anything. You haven't spoken to me for 3 weeks." And she said, "Daniel, I'm trying to advise you." And I said, "Well, your tone doesn't sound very advisory to me." and then I sort of chalked that one up for Eric.
Yeah, yeah, that's a small victory.
Yeah, that is what Eric would have done.
So just a question I want to sort of finish on, really, because I think kind of this moment is the one that encompasses, and you kind of, I think we're realising that they're taking this chip against Sunderland for granted. Taking his comeback goal against Everton's call them, different name, I have to call them Liverpool.
Yeah.
You know, all of this you take for granted. Do you think, because Cantona retires 2 years later, do you think this plays a psychological part in his retirement, in terms of he no longer wanted to have to be constrained? Not that he was constrained, because he did a flying kung fu kick. Do you think it plays any aspect of his retirement?
I don't think that did. I think he did profess disillusionment with where United were going, and like the merchandising and the corporate nature. He was absolutely spot on about that. I think if there was a reason, it was that. I think he probably was also a bit past his best. Like 96-97 was by far his worst. The last season was by far his worst season for United. Yeah. And I think that he probably, I mean, he's a free spirit, and he fancied doing something else. So that was what he decided to do. But the things, I mean, when you talk about the goal against Sunderland, for example, that was in that last season. Yeah. And that was not, that was sort of an unusual moment in that season, because he wasn't quite at his 94-96 pomp at that point, where he was just phenomenal.
So do you respect that he's probably looked at that and gone, right, I'm maybe 5% down on all areas, that's me done?
I think that I respect whatever anyone chooses to do with their own life, and this is a kind of a problem that we have with footballers, is that we believe that they owe us.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'm paying my £28.
They owe us. What they owe us is not comparable to what they owe themselves and their families. And it's the same as when you see a footballer leave a club. If a footballer wants to go and work somewhere else, I mean, I don't think that footballers should be prevented from going to work somewhere else. I think that all footballers should be represented by the PFA, mm-hmm. and the agent money shouldn't go out the game. And if a player wants to leave, then a player should be able to leave. So at least maybe maybe a mandatory buyout clause in every contract would solve that. But if a player doesn't want to work somewhere, then it's immoral of them to be forced to work somewhere. And the fact that they're paid a lot of money, which is often used as a reason to stick to beat them, but is not relevant. They're paid a lot of money because they're brilliant at what they do, and it shouldn't mean, like, you can be paid a lot of money and still be unhappy, and working somewhere you don't want to work can make you unhappy, as I think anyone would understand, even if you're getting adulation and wealth and joy and all of that kind of thing. So yeah, if Eric Cantona decides he doesn't want to play for Manchester United anymore, then whoever he was, it would be up to him. But given that he's someone who inspired United's first league title in 26 years, then won a title the next year, then booted Matthew Simmons and actually taught us something about the world, then won two more league titles, I think he is entitled to do what he likes. And it's funny when you put it in those terms, because I'm thinking, if Eric hadn't booted Matthew Simmons, I think there's a pretty good chance United would have won five league titles in a row, which no one's ever done before. But I'd still take the Matthew Simmons moment every time, because that said more to me about what Manchester United is, about who I am, and about what life means. Because, and that's even before we start thinking about, in no country in the world you really want the same team winning the league title 5 years in a row, even when it's your own team. There's something not right about that. And it's funny, because I'm going off on a tangent here, excuse me, but because when you look at the dirty money that Chelsea and City have got, without that dirty money, it is entirely feasible that Manchester United would have won every league title from 2007 to 2013. That is bad news for any league. So
that's Serie A.
Yeah, you don't want that. And also, when I think about which league titles have I enjoyed United winning the most, it's really easy. 93, 96, 2003, 2007, 2013. The ones that came after losing it the year before is much more enjoyable. But the thing about Eric Cantona is that obviously we'll always be talking about Eric Cantona, but his key contribution to folklore, to his own mythology, but also to society in a way, is that even if you just talk about his contribution to linguistics, people talk about his kung fu kick. I am willing to bet that not one person that uses that term has the slightest clue about kung fu. Why is it a kung fu kick? Why is it not a karate kick? Or just a boot? He booted him. But it's become this thing. It's become a kung fu kick, not just a boot of an idiot. But that's his most significant contribution to British society, because anyone sensible, he may think about things in a more sensible way. I mean, obviously, the FA were unable to think about it sensibly. And I remember the next day, I went to the dentist with my dad, and I went to school in Camden Town. And my dad was a teacher at that school. He was deputy head, in fact. Which meant 7 very miserable years for him while I was chalking my blazer was one of the more pleasant things I did. He was taking me to the dentist, and the dentist was a family friend, so it was in Chiswick, which is nowhere near where we lived. So on the drive from Camden Town to Chiswick, we were listening to LBC and phone-ins about Eric Cantona, where people were ringing up saying he should be kicked out of the country and should never be allowed back and all that kind of thing. And me and my dad were just shaking our heads, looking at each other, thinking, he's done an amazing thing. And he got everyone talking about something, and even if they don't always get to the correct answers, to have that kind of impact on society and on individuals like me is an amazing thing. And thank you, Eric. Okay, so my moment that I'm going to choose is I'm going to choose Brian Robson's goal at Wimbledon on the last day of the 1992-93 season. So the reason why I'm going to choose that is this. When I grew up, United were obviously crap most of the time. Like, they won a few cups, beat Liverpool, but that was about it. But the person who symbolised United in the 80s for me was Brian Robson. When I was a kid, I had to ask my parents if I could change my name from Daniel to Brian with a Y. I know. And then I had a hamster. The first hamster that I had was called Robbo. And no one will be surprised to hear that Robbo did not last that long.
Yeah.
And the following hamster...
Did it start well and then sort of have to go home after one game?
Yeah. And the next hamster I had was called Sparky. And Sparky was a lot more robust. But the thing with Brian Robson was weird, because he was this indestructible, in that when you watched him play, he played like Superman. Like a person who was indestructible, and yet he kept getting injured. So he was my first footballing hero, and the reason why he was my first footballing hero was, even as a child, so I don't really remember. I mean, I saw Brian Robson play for United, I watched him in the flesh play for United, but at an age when you're not analysing the game in a way that you analyse it when you get a bit older.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I enjoyed the whole experience, and that the first time I went to football, I don't remember. I was on the Stretford End in 1985, and I don't really remember anything about anything apart from the football. Like, I wasn't going and taking in the sights and the sounds.
Right.
I was going in and I was obsessed with the football.
Okay.
Brian Robson sort of symbolised that, and what I knew was that when Brian Robson played, United won, and when Brian Robson didn't play, United tended not to win. And the thing that really symbolises the 80s for me, there was one game when United played West Ham in February the 1st, 1986. And what had happened that season, I'd been to my first game, and United had a run of 10 straight wins to start the season. And that was when I went to my first game in that run. And they were 10 points clear at Christmas, and it looked like they were going to absolutely stroll the league. Martin Edwards sold Hughes to Barcelona from under Ron Atkinson. Atkinson probably should have made that resignation issue, but anyway. And his goals dried up, didn't really want to go to Barcelona particularly, although if he hadn't gone, we would have never had bestowed upon us the fantastic tome Barcelona, Bayern and back, which still adorns my shelves. It's a classic.
Yeah.
And, so United were playing West Ham, who were also going really well. They had a brilliant team under John Lyle. They had, like, Devonshire was still going, and they had Cotty and McAvennie up front.
They finished third that season behind.
Yeah, they did. And on the last day of the season, there were still three teams that could win the league, and United were not one of them.
Yeah.
So what happened was, United were playing West Ham and at Upton Park, and Robson scored a lovely goal, a chip running through the middle in typical Brian Robson style. Then I think West Ham equalised. Robson went off injured. And then Mark Ward equalised for West Ham. I think Cotty scored the winner after Robson went off injured, and that was basically it for United. And that sort of crystallised the 80s. United are doing well, Robson dislocates his shoulder, and then United and not doing well anymore.
Was that his most common injury? Because that's the one I always remember. It just used to always come out.
There's a picture, like the picture of him like being escorted off, holding, grabbing on one shoulder with the other, with the opposite hand, and Jim McGregor next to him.
I do wonder how many thousands of school children left the field of play like that, because it was always, that's my, I remember it because I remember from the 86 World Cup.
Yeah.
Didn't he
did it against.
Well?
He did it against. I think was it against Portugal in the first game, or maybe Morocco in the second one, when Wilkins got sent off.
And then did he go off again in 90 against Ireland?
No, I think 90 was a toe. I think 90 he injured his toe, chucking someone out of a bed after a session was actually, I think, what happened in 1990.
And we'll come on to that other side of Brian Robson.
But 1990, he was a bit past it. It was kind of nice watching Robson would chop down someone faster, and the ref would give him a kind of benevolent pat on the head, like Shearer would get later on.
Yeah, yeah.
But so Brian Robson symbolised United in the 80s, symbolised United for me, and just like what I thought United was then, like brilliant football, brilliant talent, but would somehow find a way for things to go wrong.
Yeah.
And that was who Brian Robson was. And the thing was that Brian Robson deserved to have a league title. And is Brian Robson going to win a league title? It happened again later with Steven Gerrard. I can't remember if he ever won a league title or not.
Let's not be silly, Dan. We know full well.
Oh, do you know what? I've just remembered. He said it doesn't slip, and then he slipped. That didn't really happen. I can't believe that could possibly actually happen. But so is Brian Robson going to win a league title? And then it looked like he wasn't going to. But then towards the arse end of his career, Fergie started to build a team. So you could see in 1990, I was 11, but I thought I could see that there was the bones of a team, that when you saw, well, particularly when Ince arrived, and we had United Ince and Hughes and Bruce and Pallister.
Does the cup win? Is that the first sign that United are, that's because obviously you just about win the cup in 90 with the replay and Clayton Blackmore and
Lee Martin.
Lee Martin. Palace's grey kit. No, they were in the yellow and black.
They're the yellow and black in the replay.
In the first game, and then you beat a good Barcelona side in 91. So was that the first sign of that generation?
For me, I thought the 1990, even though they had a terrible season in the league in 1990, you could see that you didn't really know what was required to win a league title because you'd never seen United do it. But it felt like when you looked at the Liverpool team, you could see they were getting old. Even though they won the league title in 1990, Souness was busy like getting rid of good. Like, was it Souness by then? Was Souness the manager then? Was it still?
Souness comes 18 months later.
I went after in 91. Went after the 4-all. The 4-all. Yeah. You could see though that Dalglish was signing players who weren't as good as the players that he had.
Speedy, Carter.
Spackman,
yeah.
And he had.
Although my brother's Liverpool fans, and I'll tell you, Spackman was a much underrated player. But I completely Barnes, not. I think Barnes had an Achilles injury,
and then loses his pace. And Rush comes back, and he's not the same player. And he gets in the way of Aldridge, and all these kinds of things. He's not replacing players with players who are as good. Ablett was not as good a player as Alan Hansen.
That's why he ended up at us.
And then he was also, he had this thing with David Burrows. I think it was Souness who later decides it's a good idea to get rid of Staunton and keep Burrows, because they played the same position. But all these players are Steve Harkness and Nicky Tanner.
Just to go off on a very big tangent, but is it something that United, maybe 18 months ago, not now, because there are some good players coming through United, but some of United's youth players, just the likes of the lad who ended up at Sunderland,
Donald Glove.
Yeah, you know, players like that who were coming through who weren't quite, you know, obviously were good enough to come through at United, but then weren't good enough to play for United.
Well, generally the standard's really high, so to get players through, if you look at what Fergie did, and Fergie loved young players, he got Lee Sharp, then he got Giggs in the class of 92, then from the class of 92 to the end he got Wes Brown,
John O'Shea
they signed from Waterford when he was quite old, so he probably doesn't count. They got Wes Brown and Darren Fletcher, and that was a manager who was committed to doing this. Like, you're only, and it's the reason why we're seeing Barcelona struggle relatively. They're still winning these because they've still got Messi and good players, and that league's, and more money than everyone else in the league. But you're not getting a midfield like Busquets, Xavi, and Iniesta probably as long as you live.
Yeah.
So it's very hard. Like, you can't. The reason why, when people talk about weaknesses in squads, then they've got no replacement for this brilliant player. That's why. That's, of course, you haven't. It's not possible.
Yeah.
But Liverpool,
because these are once and Robson in his own way was a once in a lifetime player.
Yeah, you can't replace those players. And so Liverpool didn't go about. I mean, they spent all the money on the by far the best Liverpool team I saw in that area, the 87-88 team. Spent a lot of money putting that team together, but then they didn't spend the money to renovate that team when it needed renovating.
So because quite a lot of those players, even when they bring Houghton in what, late 87, early 88, he's still in his late 20s, early 30s. Now it seems that when you want to renovate teams, you're bringing in 24 to 27, but back then it was 28 to 31.
You bring someone in at their peak because you can afford to.
Yeah.
Houghton cost them, £900,000, I think. And yeah, they could afford to pay for Houghton. Whereas now, to get a high-level player out of a high-level team, you can't really afford to do that because you're not going to have them for very long.
No.
But it felt like the standard of... So when United had their Bruce and Pallister were there, and they had Ince in midfield, who to me looked like he was, to my childish eyes, looked like he was going to be a high-level player. And then you had Hughes up front and McClare, who were a partnership that worked. So at that point, you're starting to feel like there's the bones of a proper team here, and I don't think the teams that are winning the league are that good either. And then Arsenal win the league in 91, and they only lose one game to Chelsea, I think, the whole season. But you're looking at that, and they murdered United in the game where they clinched the title, where Adam Smith scores a hat-trick. But at the same time, you're looking at them thinking, which of this lot would I actually take? And the answer is not that many of them.
I think all that Arsenal side, just on the tangent, because it's nice to discuss how those sides are put together, and how Robson, just to bring it back to Robson in a bit, and I think, you know, we're going to be talking about the 99 team, which kind of becomes the most balanced side that United had, particularly with that spine, is that you take out of that Arsenal time, you take Seaman at his peak in the later Arsenal sides, but at that moment in 89-91 it was Lukic, but you've got that whole back four.
You've got the back four,
and then you've got a core midfield, and it's something that I think when Arsenal get to 2005 they no longer, you know, so it's about this idea that teams aren't replicating or replacing, or to use your phrase, renovating what they're doing, because Arsenal get to 2005 and they lose that same, they don't have that same solid back four, but that same solid middle two of a Rocastle or the middle players that they had in midfield, and then obviously Vieira and Petit, who were just, again, you know, sometimes I think we're a bit harsh on teams for not replacing players because they, as we say, they can't be replaced.
I think people think, and I agree with them, people who know, watch more of Arsenal than I do, that Wenger actually he broke up the 2014 too early.
Yeah.
That he didn't have to let Gilberto Silva leave. I think Edu went because he wanted to, but when you've got people who know how to win, get rid of them at your peril, because knowing how to win is not tangible, and you can't measure it in XG or in heat maps or any of that stuff. And I'm not saying it's to have a go at those things, because I understand the uses of those things, but there's also X factor.
Yeah.
Or they don't measure mental strength.
Yeah.
The ability to get it done when you're under pressure. And having people that know how to win is important when you're forming any team, which is sort of the other side of the coin that Gary Neville talks about. United won the League Cup in 2006, and he says that that was an important staging post for that team because it showed them that they could win things. For me, actually, it's funny, I was at a friend's wedding in South Africa, so I missed that final, and I was pleased not to be there because they pissed me off during the previous two seasons.
Yeah.
And I didn't really need to see them cavorting around Cardiff at my expense after they spent 2 years messing about for beating Wigan. But so Brian Robson never won this league title, and then he's crucial in United winning the Cup Winners' Cup, which was brilliant, which was a brilliant and hilarious in retrospect false storm for English football, because that was the first season back, and everyone thinks Arsenal got embarrassed by Benfica in the European Cup, or I think it was already the Champions League then, by Itzias particularly. They smashed Standard Liège about 7-1 or something in the first round. Then they play Benfica and they get embarrassed at Highbury in the second leg of the second round. But United then go and beat Barcelona in the final, and one of the spawniest semi-final draws ever. The four teams in the semi-finals are United, Legia Warsaw, Juventus and Barcelona, and United get Legia Warsaw. But by this point, that season was Lee Sharp's breakthrough season.
Yeah.
And some of the greatest football that United played under Fergie in some ways, and some of the most exciting was in that season in the League Cup, where they're not Liverpool out. Liverpool, I think, hadn't lost a game that season, and when we're seeing all the charts about the current Liverpool side's winning runs, mm-hmm. that Liverpool team are in that list of having got the same number of points after the same number of games. Then United beat them up at Old Trafford and win 3-1, and then they beat Arsenal. I think Arsenal was the next round, 6-2, which was also when Thatcher, when that was the last day of Thatcher. And yeah.
just for the benefit of the tape, I'm raising a fist.
And which is one of those games that they beat Arsenal 6-2 at Highbury, which is one of those games that sticks with me, because I went to queue up with my dad and a mate from school for tickets for that game in the Arsenal end, and there was a queue for seats and there was a queue for terraces, and it was not that long after Hillsborough.
Yeah.
And so my dad decided that he wasn't going to take responsibility for taking my mate in on the terraces without having consulted with his parents. And it was the days before mobile phones, obviously. Little did he know that my friend, his parents were people that did not care about that stuff. But so then they sell all the tickets, and we're in the seats for the stand, and then people who are in the seats for the terraces buy seats for the stand. So we queue up for 2 hours, nobody having been told that we're easily getting tickets, and we end up not getting tickets.
Yeah.
And then United go and smash Arsenal 6-2. And these shops, it's just like.
And that was his.
In a lot of ways, that was when the Fergie era properly began. Yeah. Because that was United playing United football with young players and wingers, and there's also Danny Wallace's greatest hours. Although, as we're talking about commentary before, there's a Barry Davis line when United beat Oldham the previous season. He goes, test of his pace, test of his finish, and Danny Wallace scores against Oldham. But anyway, that is fantastic. And so United beat Arsenal 6-2, and then they beat Leeds. They knocked Leeds out in the semi-final, where they beat them at home, and then Sharp scores a brilliant goal in the last minute.
Is this Leeds title winning season?
No, it's the one before.
So it's their first season back.
And Lee Sharp scores a brilliant, and then they go to Wembley, but they end up getting beat by Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
But it was that run where it was exciting, it was scintillating, the football was brilliant, and everyone started to think, actually, this is a pretty good team now. And then they go to Barcelona, they beat them, and then they were set for the league title. And obviously they bottled it, the pit, like, there were a lot of different reasons, but they ran out of goals. That was the main reason. They ran out of goals in the second half of the season.
Didn't help either, did
it? No, but it was gone by then. It was the main thing I would say is they ran out of goals. They were struggling. They either struggled to score from chances, or they struggled to create chances. And they ended up, Old Trafford was also a classic old traffic quagmire of the era, which made playing nice football difficult. But then they had to play, was it 3 games in 5 days? And they couldn't score, they couldn't win, and then they lost to Nottingham Forest. I think they were winning, and they lost 2-1 to Forest on Easter Monday at home. Scott Gemmell scores. Did you know that Scott is with 1T? And the reason why Scott is with 1T is because it's short for Scotland. Yeah,
I didn't. He came and had 18 months at Everton towards the end of his career, and he's one of the few players who turned up at Everton late in their career that I thought I'd have liked to have had you early on.
He could pass, but he was slow.
Like sort of prototype Darren Gibson.
Yeah.
But just moving towards the end. One of the things was, do you think Robson got the end at United that he deserved? I mean, I know with the league title, but Ferguson, I felt, handled them really well.
I would say Fergie, when he talks about his regrets, Fergie says one of his regrets is not putting Robbo on the bench for the 1994 Cup final, which would have been his last game for United.
Right.
And instead of being a romantic, which he was really, I think.
But he was also a pragmatist. But
he put Sharp. I think was it Sharp and McClure on the bench, like players he might have actually wanted to use. And United then smashed Chelsea 4-0. Yeah. McClure scores, but he could have had Robson. But so then United lose. United don't win the league, and it looks like Robson's never going to manage it. And then the next season, he's basically not a first choice anymore, because United sign Cantona, they move McClure back into midfield.
Yeah.
And Robson Robson does, he plays a bit, so he's someone you bring on when you're trying to see out a game. And then United win the league, and Robson and Steve Bruce lift the trophy together, and everyone cries, and it's a great moment.
Spoiled slightly by Steve Bruce whacking the camera.
and those,
remember those horrible Premier League medals?
Yes, with the miniatures. The trophy itself is so 1990s.
It is, isn't it? I can't believe they've not like said, you are to United, you keep it. And we'll, no, it's all right.
Just go back to the Football League Division One trophy, beautiful old one.
It doesn't belong to them, does it?
Yeah.
But ultimately, I'm just going to wrap it up.
Yeah.
If I had to, the two things that we've spoken about today, your two number sevens, as we know, you've got literally that number seven burnt into your heart. If I had to, I mean, I know comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah.
But if I had to ask you to take one number seven with you,
oh, Cantona, it's not a question. I mean, the thing about that Robson, what happened? Because Gary, just to quickly sum up what actually happened is, so United get a free kick. They're beating Blackburn. They've won the league. They're beating Blackburn 2-1, and they get a free kick in the last minute. And Gary Pallister takes it because he's the only member of the first team that hasn't scored the season. And he scores,
but plus the rumor has it we're still blathered from the night before.
I hope that they all were. If you remember the jacket that Ryan Giggs was wearing, the black and white stripe, he certainly was. But then United go to Wimbledon and as champions, and I was there with my dad, and obviously we'd watched United together for all my life, as long as I can remember, watching United not win the league. And I'd been having my dad's tales of the Busby Babes and Bessor and Charlton and all these leagues that United had won that my dad had seen that I hadn't seen. And then United won it up, and it was 1-1. They win 2-0, so they won it up, and then the ball goes through, and oh my God, Robson's running onto it, and you kind of, I remember me and my dad clutching each other because this was the moment. Brian Robson hadn't scored, and somehow the ball has broken to allow him through. And so when someone goes through on the one-on-one, it's kind of, I mean, it's nerve-wracking for the players because they've got time to think about it, and it's nerve-wracking for the supporters because you're like, this is like, we're on the cusp of an eternal moment here. Is Brian Robson going to score? And he slots it, and there's an explosion from all around the ground, because the same as Selhurst Park again, the ground is United everywhere, and Brian Robson has scored, and you get that beautiful ending that you don't think it's possible to get, and you get it, and it's that crowning moment of Brian Robson has basically, like, you felt like Brian Robson has completed his life's work, and to be able to be there for that moment and to see it with my dad was amazing. And something, I mean, I've been to seen United win 2 European Cups, I've been to 4 European Cup finals, and weirdly in some ways my favourite moment in European Cup final was when Rooney scored against Barcelona at Wembley. But even though I knew United were going to lose that game because they were miles out of their depth, the goal made it 1-1, but I knew they were going to get beat, is that my dad's a teacher, so I hadn't been able to come to the other finals with me, but he was there at that one, and celebrating a goal in the European Cup final with my dad was a special moment. It's the first game my dad had ever been to on a Saturday, because he's religious and keeps the Jewish rules, and but they live walking distance to Wembley, and I remember we set off for the game and my mum goes, make sure the neighbours don't see, and my dad goes, what are you talking about, going to the European Cup final, I want everyone to see. But yeah, I mean, that's really like what football is about, like those moments, whether it's with your mates or with your, because when I was in Barcelona for the 99 final, it was my first season of being in charge of my own football going, and so I didn't really have mates from the match, so I was on my own, and there's something special about I made this happen by myself. But when United won it again in Moscow, and I was there behind the goal where watching John Terry slip with my mates who I've been going with for years by then, like, that is more special, even though it didn't clinch the treble or whatever. It's like sharing those moments with other people, those eternal moments of drama and joy and love and life and all this kind of stuff that you would put on a poster and it would sound appalling, is what football's about. And that Brian Robson goal properly encapsulated what football's about. My dad passing that down to me and then the two of us enjoying it together, and then me thinking, yeah, this is what life's about.
Well, there we go. That was a fantastic chat with Daniel, I think, wasn't it? Obviously, football memories and moments, don't want to see that sort of thing on a football pitch. We really do want to see that sort of thing on a football pitch. It was great. It was just fascinating that out of all the things that Eric Cantona has done, this standing up to bullies, standing up to people that are in this age, and obviously Daniel's you know, his Jewish upbringing, where he's probably had to put up with quite a lot of silliness as well, and in his own ways, and he's put up with it. But I hope you enjoyed that. I did. And yeah, you can catch Daniel on his social media at Daniel Harris. The Busby film, by the time we come out, I think would have had its cinematic run, but I'm sure you'll be able to find that in all good streaming providers. And yeah, so thanks for joining us for another week. I hope you have enjoyed it. Please like, rate, subscribe. What is it you need to do? And we'll be back soon. Take care.